KRWG News This Week. I'm Fred Martino. Thanks for being with us. Las Cruces Public Schools outlined a plan to increase face-to-face learning during this week's school board meeting. In depth, here's Madison Staten.
Small groups of students will be returning to in-person learning within the Las Cruces School District starting February 22nd. Earlier this month, school board members voted to allow select groups of students to return to the classroom in a modified hybrid plan. School board member Teresa Tenorio, who spoke out against a full hybrid reopening, says she's hopeful the new plan will balance both health and safety while still prioritizing continued education efforts.
I think I was willing to go in this direction to experiment with the reopening as long as it wasn't too big where we would have bigger mistakes. And what I see now is with this plan is even when we start small with such a big district, it still has a significant impact.
Not every student will have the opportunity to return to the classroom. Elementary and middle schools will focus on the students who have struggled the most with the move to online learning. For now, the district will concentrate on those with poor internet connection, those in need of additional emotional support, and students who have not engaged with the curriculum, shown by a lack of assignment submission or general understanding of the material. Over 700 middle school and 1,700 elementary school students will be part of the modified hybrid plan. Superintendent Karen Trujillo says that while students will be in the classroom 2 days a week for a few hours each day, the district is not currently implementing the full hybrid model.
We're not in a hybrid model. We're not compelling anybody to go into the building. We're not doing like the changing of classes and all students are there 2 days a week. It's kind of like transitioning into hybrid, then to hybrid, then to full. So we're kind of like at that very beginning stage.
High schoolers physically returning will be in the classroom 2 full days a week, while more than 75% will continue to be educated entirely online. Trujillo says in-person students will be assigned to a smaller cohort instead of bouncing from class to class.
The cohort of the student will stay the same, but it might be a team of teachers that are working with them. It might just be a group that needs help with math and science. So one day it might be a math teacher that's in there helping them, and one day it might be a science.
Teachers will have the opportunity to wait until after receiving the second dose of the COVID vaccine before returning to the classroom. According to Trujillo, 82% of the staff requesting the vaccine has already been given access.
Overall, we had 1,911 people request vaccinations, and we were able to arrange that for close to 1,600. We have 3,412 employees, 1,911 requested vaccination, and that is 56%.
Since November, 5 staff members have been lost to the coronavirus. Prior to a moment of silent remembrance during the meeting, Trujillo emphasized how serious the district is taking the pandemic.
I mean, it really does bring it home. So when people talk about, you know, that we don't care about our teachers or our students, that is the furthest thing from the truth. And I want our community to know that we take this very, very, very seriously. And we want to honor the needs of our students and the needs of our staff, but really our community.
School Board President Ray Jaramillo called on the community to partner with the district to ensure the health and safety of staff and students.
I think that it's complicated, and I would use the complexity of this to really ask the community for help. We have to stay in the yellow. We have to move towards the green for this to work, because if we go the other way, we can't get to that full hybrid model that can support families.
An expansion of current in-person learning opportunities is expected to be discussed at the next school board meeting in March. For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
The number of people trying to cross the southwest border illegally has steadily increased during the pandemic. Figures just released by U.S. Customs and Border Protection show that in January alone, nearly 3,000 people a day were taken into custody. The vast majority were quickly expelled under Title 42, a policy implemented by the Trump administration to prevent the spread of COVID-19. KTEP's Angela Cocherga reports from El Paso, where more and more migrants are climbing over the border wall, suffering serious injuries.
People living along this stretch of border west of El Paso just have to look up to know this is a hotspot for smugglers moving migrants across the border. CBP helicopters fly overhead day and night. These teens peeking through the border fence from the Mexican side tell me they see a lot of people climbing over the barrier, many using ladders. That's despite the fact the Trump administration upgraded the barricade to a 30-foot tall bollard-style structure. Two of the men who tried to scale the fence near El Paso in recent weeks and fell are now at a migrant shelter in the desolate Mexican border town, Palomas, nearly 100 miles away. They're recovering from serious injuries.
Me caí. Ahí terminó todo para mí.
Juan Jairo Ushka Alcocer, a 25-year-old man from Ecuador, says his dream of reaching the U.S. ended at the foot of the wall. Pedro Gomez, a 37-year-old man from Guatemala, tells me he slipped and toppled off the top of the fence. The men want their full names used so their account of events can be verified. They're among a growing number of desperate migrants climbing the border barrier with dangerous and sometimes deadly consequences. Gomez, a father of four, has casts on both legs and sits in a wheelchair. Ushka Alcocer lies on a bunk bed. Both say they told the Border Patrol agents who picked them up that they were injured and in pain. Gomez says he was crawling on his hands and knees when approached by Border Patrol agents, unable to walk. Ushka Alcocer says he told agents he couldn't move after his fall. Even so, both say they were returned quickly to Mexico without medical care. According to CBP, neither, quote, presented illness or injury during their brief encounters with agents. But Pastor Rosalio Sosa, who runs the migrant shelter where the injured men are recovering, says he's seen it happen numerous times.
And they don't have any medical attention, nothing. They just pick them up and send them over here. No wheelchairs, no nothing. Not even a Tylenol.
According to El Paso Border Patrol Chief Gloria Chavez, when it's apparent someone is hurt, agents administer first aid and request assistance if needed. That may include an agent trained as an emergency medical technician or an ambulance, depending on the severity of the injury. The higher border fence is part of an enforcement strategy designed to deter illegal crossings by making it more difficult and dangerous.
But this just hasn't happened.
Yeva Yusonite is author of the book Threshold, Emergency Responders on the U.S.-Mexico Border. She's worked as a paramedic and is a professor of international security and anthropology at Brown University.
The border infrastructure is getting deadlier, and people's reasons for moving are increasing as well. So it is just a bad combination.
That combination is resulting in more serious border wall injuries. Ruben Garcia is director of Annunciation House, an organization that provides temporary shelter for migrants and refugees in El Paso.
When I say serious injuries, I'm talking about fractured legs in multiple places, fractured ankles, broken hips, pelvises. I'm talking about broken ribs, spinal injuries.
The injured migrants at Annunciation House were sent to the hospital first by Border Patrol, says Garcia. Most were women. Back near the border fence, after sunset, neighbors on both sides expect another busy night. Janet Lara lives in the U.S.
The border patrols are up and down, helicopters, so we're like, oh, it's normal to us, you know?
Her mobile home is on the last street near the border wall, where the dreams of migrants trying to reach the United States start and sometimes end. I'm Angela Cocherga in El Paso.
To state politics now, and we continue our conversations with some New Mexico state lawmakers from our area during this legislative session. This week, Democratic State Senator Jeff Steinborn, Anthony Moreno, talked with Senator Steinborn about legislation he's sponsoring that he says could allow local governments and pueblos in the state to go into the energy business.
Senator Steinborn, thank you so much for joining us for the program.
My pleasure. Good to be with you, Anthony.
I want to talk with you about SB 83, the Local Choice Energy Act.
Yeah.
Is this going to allow communities to start their own utility?
It could. So the local, right now, you know, we are all pretty much beholden to one energy provider. You know, in our community here in Las Cruces, we, Doñana County, we have to use El Paso Electric. And then that flows from that a regulatory structure through the PRC, and they really, you know, control the rules of the game, and they get paid on building more infrastructure and more power plants, and they fight everything that could produce more efficiencies to reduce the use of energy because they get paid on building more infrastructure, which I think is really a fundamentally, you know, counter intuitive to the interest of New Mexicans. So what this bill would do is it would allow local communities, counties, and tribes the opportunity to purchase energy from whoever they want for their communities. And that would include a city like Las Cruces creating its own public utility, going into the energy business. It's done all over the place. In fact, here in New Mexico, the city of Farmington does that, and their energy rates are much lower than the rest of us pay. There are cities like Austin, Texas, who have great public utilities that keep energy costs down. And then the model flips on its head, in which case your incentive is not to produce more energy, it's to conserve energy and to limit the construction of new power plants and hence new costs that have to then pay that off. So it's really unleashing a democratization of energy purchasing. And that's what I'm trying to do with Senate Bill 83. It passed its first committee, Senate Conservation Committee, which is very exciting. And now we're waiting on a hearing in the Senate Tax Transportation, we renamed it, and Industry Committee. So there you go. So that's your first piece of homework to your listeners, is you can go online and you can send an email to members of that committee if you support that bill.
What do you know about what we've seen with legislation like this in other states?
It's called Community Choice Aggregate. Community Choice Aggregation is what it's known by nationally. There's 9 other states that allow this, and it's working well. There's facets of what we've learned here in New Mexico on how the things to watch out for, but generally speaking, where there's community choice aggregation, where local communities have this choice, they end up with less expensive energy and greener energy. I think a lot of communities would really want as green energy as they can get, which is sometimes the cheapest energy out there, and this would really unlock the full potential of that opportunity.
What about the technical issues that come along with this? What are some things that we need to consider if this is adopted and put into place?
It's really important that we have reliable energy, obviously. I think that's the most important aspect, that you know, whoever is our energy provider, when you turn on the light switch, that it works, or the heater, that it works during a storm. And so our legislation has provisions in there requiring reliability, proof of reliability. We're actually strengthening that section of the bill to add even more stuff. So that's number one importance to me, technical requirements. And then there's just facets of the bill, like when a provider is replaced, then they are entitled to what's called an exit fee to recover their investment costs that they may have made to service that market in good faith, understanding that they were going to service these customers for however long into the future. So it's appropriate to reimburse them and to keep them whole, so to speak, for those costs in a reasonable way. That's a really important aspect. It's called an exit fee to get right so that it's reasonable, but it's not so unreasonable that cost stacked onto the new cost of the new provider make it such that it's no longer feasible to choose a new company. That's an issue that I know in some states they've wrestled with, and that we're trying to get the right language in this legislation to allow for reasonable but not excessive cost recovery.
District 36 Democratic State Senator Jeff Steinborn, again, thank you very much for your time.
It's been my honor. Thanks for having me.
Well, of course, the economy is a major concern for New Mexico legislators as well as public officials across the country. So where are things going? New Mexico State University hosted the 2021 Economic Outlook Conference covering both the state and national economies. In depth, here's Madison Staten.
If there's a reoccurring theme from the 2021 Economic Outlook Conference, it's the vast economic uncertainty from the pandemic that has led to high unemployment across the nation. Wells Fargo economist Charles Doherty emphasized its reduced economic growth at a historic rate.
A lot of what's happened over the past year or so has been directly tied to the pandemic, the coronavirus. We saw the sharpest reduction in economic growth that, you know, maybe we've ever seen, aside from maybe back to World War II.
According to a Pew Research Center report, 1 in 4 adults have had trouble paying their bills since the start of the pandemic. Doherty says that while some of the over 22 million jobs lost have been regained, the recovery rate has slowed down.
We've only recovered about 50% of the jobs, a little bit more than 50%, but, you know, essentially we've lost 22 million and we've recovered about 12 million. So we're still very much in the hole here. Furthermore, over the past few months, we've sort of slowed down in terms of job growth.
In December of 2020, the national unemployment rate rose to 6.7%, up more than 3% from the previous year. At 8.2%, the state of New Mexico far exceeded the national average, ranking 46th in the nation. Jim Peach, a professor emeritus of economics at New Mexico State University, highlighted the stark economic changes caused by the pandemic in New Mexico.
We were finally above the level of the Great Recession. And then between February and April, we dropped 105,000 jobs in the state. And that's just an awful lot. We gained some of that back. We're at 795,000 as of December.
Peach says the hardest hit sectors in New Mexico include both mining and the leisure and hospitality industries.
Leisure and hospitality lost 32,000 jobs between January and December of last year. And the other sector that I'd like you to take a look at is mining, and that's minus 7,500 jobs out of about 25,000 jobs. Those two sectors are really important in the state. Leisure and hospitality accounted for almost 100,000 jobs before this started.
But there's a bright spot in the economic outlook: consumer spending. Wells Fargo economist Charles Doherty says increased national personal consumption of items like exercise equipment and electronics have helped to stabilize the economy. He forecasts spending will further increase this spring.
You see a big increase in personal consumption expenditures, which is, you know, just economics parlance for consumer spending. You see durable goods, that's the Peloton bike, basketball hoop, the laptop computer, that's actually risen not only back to where it started, but 10% above that since last February. So we've seen this big surge in personal or durable goods spending. And that's a big reason why the overall economy has fared, you know, reasonably well over the past few months.
Doherty predicts the national economy will regain its pre-pandemic strength by the third quarter of 2021, on the assumption that COVID cases continue to go down. He says as the weather grows warmer and people begin to resume normal economic activity, the economy will recover.
We actually think the economy grows just a shade above 5% this year and a shade above 5% next year. So that doesn't sound like much, but if you think about what I was saying at this time last year, I was talking about 2% growth and how great 2% growth was. So clearly we're digging ourselves out of a hole.
For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
Last March, the StoryCorps Military Voices Initiative visited Las Cruces, and every week we're presenting portions of the interviews conducted during that visit. Today, a second portion of the interview with Air Force veteran Ellen Steele, who spoke with KRWG's own Emily Guerra.
So was there a reason that you wanted to join?
Yes, absolutely. First of all, the culture that I came from, I was a divorced woman. Didn't matter how young I was or what was going on. One day I was walking down the sidewalk in town. One of my great aunts with all of her brew were coming towards me, and she saw it was me, and she literally took them across the street so that she didn't have to speak to me. And at that particular point, being 18, I mean, I wasn't that old, I decided to go into the, and I couldn't afford college. We were very poor. So I went into the Air Force mainly for an education. Boy, did I get an education, but it wasn't exactly the one that I may have been looking for. As a neuropsych, and it was a brand new field, and I learned a great deal about people and the neurosis that they have and how to protect them and how to help them and, you know.
Did you have a best friend while you were in the military?
I did, and we essentially... She was the other neuropsych. We went through training together. We considered ourselves sisters. She became godmother to my children.
Do you want to talk about a funny moment you guys did together? Or
being from Detroit, she was really a city kid. And here I am, this little dope from the hills of West Virginia. One thing, and it's thing that doesn't happen anymore, of course. In the state of Florida, you could not be in the car with a black person unless the black person was sitting in the front seat and you were in the back seat or something. Well, there was a real good movie on at the drive-in theater, so... Five of us grabbed our friend, who was black, and a rug or something, and put her in the car and covered her up. I mean, she was one of us, and so we took her to the movies. Well, that was fine, until somebody wanted to get out of the car and go to get something to eat, and opened the door, and the light came on. And the people in the next car saw that she was black and there was two white girls there with her. The three of us were sitting in the back seat. And they immediately started, call the cops. And so they went ahead and called the cops. And we had quite a chase. And we went to the Eglin, to our base, and went through the... We were stopped. And so all of us piled out and went through the gate walking. And, of course, the MPs were there, or APs we called them, were there and would not allow the sheriff to arrest any of us or take us in.
And how long, in total time, how long were you in the Air Force?
3.5 years. And I had gotten married. And they had told me, you can go with your husband. Well, when I said, okay, I'm going with my husband, because he was going to Spain. And they said, no, there's no way you can go. You're going to have to stay here. And I thought, ugh. So at that time, if you were a female and you got pregnant, they would get you out of the service within 24 hours. It wasn't like it is now. So I just went ahead and got pregnant.
So that was your transition from military life to civilian life, going to Spain.
Well, yes, and it was very interesting because then all of my clothes and everything came. And I was putting up my clothes, and there were all my uniforms. And as I packed my uniforms away and I realized that I could never wear them again, I cried for 2 days, guys, and I'm not necessarily a crier, okay? But I cried for 2 days. That hurt me so bad.
Because you really loved what you did.
Well, I loved the Air Force. I really and truly did. I'm glad that I have had the life that I have had, and I'm looking forward to the life that I'm going to have. But I really and truly believe women need to be in the military.
To hear the entire interview with Ellen Steele and other StoryCorps segments, we have you covered online. It's an amazing archive. Check out the StoryCorps page under radio at krwg.org. Funding for this segment provided by the Heritage Assisted Living, taking COVID-19 precautions and offering specialized care for their residents accepting admission in their three sanitized homes. More information at 575-525-9215 or heritage-lc.com. KRWG News This Week. I'm Fred Martino. So great to be with you. Well, we're really excited about this. We're beginning a six-part series on KRWG News This Week, the New Mexico Rural Heritage Oral History Project. Is a collaboration between anthropologists at New Mexico State University and the Oral History Program at the New Mexico Farm and Ranch Heritage Museum in Las Cruces. The goal of the project was to record the memories of New Mexicans who grew up in rural parts of the state in the first half of the 20th century. This series brings together some of those stories. In the early to mid-20th century, rural New Mexicans lacked most of the comforts that many of us are accustomed to today. In the first episode of this series, we feature some of our favorite stories about daily life.
After being ruled by Spain, Mexico, and the U.S. for nearly 300 years, the territory of New Mexico officially entered the United States as the 47th state on January 6, 1912. In this series of podcasts, we will share stories of New Mexicans who experienced life in the land of enchantment in the 20th century. Each of our interview subjects spent a good portion of their life in rural areas of the state. They were asked to describe their daily life as they knew it. We start things off with Lobeo Martinez. He was born in the 1930s in Dixon, New Mexico.
You know, I grew up in what you call a small country village with no facilities, no deprived, not even electricity, running water, inside bathroom. And, of course, you run around with your friends. You go horseback riding, go swimming in the creek, you know, stuff like that. Play marbles and tops, and, you know, the old primitive games and stuff. And we played basketball in a dirt court, not even concrete or inside, you know, and no television, and with a kerosene lamp on top of the table at night to do homework or to visit. Nice big fire in the winter. We always look forward to holidays like Thanksgiving and Christmas, stuff like that. But we also worked every day chopping wood, holding water, you know, and feeding the animals. I grew up, we always had hogs and chickens and cows, you know, mostly for beef and milk, a team of horses. That's the kind of life you had in those days. If it snowed, you'd get out there with a shovel and clean the yards, you'd get muddy. Just imagine being in a town with no electricity, no telephones, no payroll, no vehicles, you know, automobiles.
David Duran was also born near Dixon in 1945. Here is his firsthand account of growing up in the Embudo-Dixon area.
I don't remember a lot about my years in Dixon. It's a small village, all adobe-type buildings, narrow roads, dirt roads. Nobody had running water, electricity, gas, or anything like that. So I remember the outhouses and the wells, the water wells in the yard that were pretty shallow to get water. The wood stoves that you would use for cooking and heating and also for warming water. No toys.
No toys?
No such thing as a toy other than what you played with.
Up next is Bronson Springstead. Bronson was born in 1936 in Chaco Canyon, then moved to Springstead, New Mexico. He describes the importance of heating the home without electricity.
Well, the kitchen stove was a wood-burning stove, but it also would burn coal. Well, we had wood all the time for cooking in the summer, but in the winter, he'd have a load of coal delivered from Gallup and just piled on the north side of the house. And so you'd start that fire with the wood and then probably cook on that. But then the heat for the house, you put coal in there and heat the house. And there was no insulation. That house had no insulation in the roof. It was just the rock walls, and I always thought it was always cold. Anyway, they had built a fireplace there, but you know, fireplaces aren't very efficient. But I can remember it would be so cold, my mother would, we had bunk beds, my older brother and I. So before we went to bed, she'd take a iron skillet and heat it on the stove, and then she'd go and lift the top sheet and run that iron skillet in between the sheets on both our beds before we got in bed. Yeah, it's kind of cool. It lasted for a little while.
Grady McCullough was born in 1928 in San Angelo, Texas. He moved to House, New Mexico when he was 2 years old. His family were homesteaders.
It was always fun keeping heat going during the winter. Another interesting job was picking up cow chips. Because just like the early settlers picked up as they were moving along, they'd pick up buffalo chips and toss them under the wagon. Well, on a weekend we'd go out and one weekend and gather cow chips and pile them in piles, and then the next weekend we'd go out with a wagon, bring in a wagon load of cow chips to give a little substance to those instead of just hauling out ashes all the time. We also went to the breaks, the edge of the cap rock, and got juniper and mesquite grubs to add as fuel to keep us warm. And then we'd add a little coal. We'd drop a piece of coal in, particularly in the cook stove in the kitchen, for longer burning, substantial heat, because the cow chips was real hot and then.
For those that grew up in New Mexico in the 1900s, water access didn't always come easy. These next few clips describe different ways they could collect it. Larry Gordon was born in 1926 in Oklahoma and moved to New Mexico in 1930.
I remember my grandparents, they had it in a, they had a windmill, and they kept it in the right below the water coming out of the ground. And I don't think we didn't have a system. We didn't attach as much importance to it as we do today.
Lonnie Harper was born January 2nd, 1936.
We had a windmill, and I can remember a storage tank. It probably held 1,500 gallons, and we put it on a stand that was probably 12 to 15 foot in the air, and it was a round tank. And we would pump water from the windmill. The windmill tower, as I remember, was 24 foot at the bottom of the tower, to where was the platform where we did the work. There was a little over 20 feet from that platform to the ground. And we would pipe it on up as high as that pipe would get, and then let it gravity flow over into the round tank. And since it was built up on stilts, we call it, or on a tower, it would give enough gravity flow. I can remember plumbing it, you know, putting a 1-inch pipe, a galvanized pipe, and running us a line and insulating the line so it didn't freeze.
Monty Shriver was born in El Dorado on September 28, 1934, and his family moved to Aztec in 1937.
What I remember about growing up was we had a cistern. Oh, we had an outhouse, of course. And we had a cistern, and we had a filtration system where they run the ditch water through two chambers filled with rocks. And they'd run the ditch water through this, and then it would go into the cistern, and then we'd add chlorine to it. Because I remember then we had a bucket that my dad would go out and just on a rope and drop it down and fill it up with water and bring it in, and there was a little cup there, and I had to stand on a stool, of course, to take the cup and get a drink of the water. And then whenever it was empty, went out and filled it. My dad filled it up again.
Luis Cabaldon was born in 1940 and grew up in Irizarry, south of Tijeras, in the 1950s.
My grandmother, I had some barrels out there to catch rainwater, and she used that rainwater for laundry. Mm-hmm. She liked that, she preferred that. And to wash their hair, they preferred that rainwater, because it's soft water.
Richard Chavez was born and raised in Puerto de Luna and works with the community as a board director of the New Mexico Rural Water Association.
Yeah, so that was our drinking water, and that was also the water that they used to cook beans. That was the only kind of water you could cook beans with. You couldn't cook beans with no other water because it was too hard. You know, but that water that came from the heavens was the best water for cooking beans and any other food that my mother cooked.
Up next is Lucille Roland Wolf, who was born in Artesia, New Mexico in 1925 and grew up nearby in Atoka.
The wood stove had on the side a thing, a boiler. It kept the water hot, the wood stove. So you just took the hot water out of the place where it got hot when you had the fire in the stove, put it in the tin tub and took your bath.
Francis Beeman was born in 1930 and grew up in the communities of Malaga and Loving. Both are near Carlsbad, New Mexico.
One of the grocery stores had an overhead water tank, and we had no water in Malaga proper. They hauled water from Carlsbad on a railroad track, a railroad car, and pumped it into an overhead tank at what was called Bruce's store. There was a lady, a widow lady that owned that store. And she had an overhead tank, and they pumped the water into her tank, and she sold it by the barrel for 50 cents a barrel for people who were drinking water. Now, those of us that didn't have drinking water had to buy the water, or we had well water for other uses, for livestock and bathroom use and all that, but we couldn't drink the water.
Bronson returns in this next clip and shares a story about well water. His father, who went by the nickname Colonel, owned a trading post.
So he had him drill a well, 800 foot deep. 800 foot deep. And then they built a big cistern and they plastered it. And so when the windmill took off, it would fill that cistern. And so the Navajos found it was free water. So now the word got around that if you could trade with Colonel, you can take your wagons and your 100-gallon drums. They all had steel drums. And you could go up there and bale all up and fill all your water cans up for free. So that's a pretty good idea.
He also brings up pest control around the house.
Pests and stuff like that, you couldn't have mice. So we had cats, which was a good thing, but he also had two big bull snakes that he kept back there. And
that worked.
And that we kept mice free, I'll tell you that. Those bull snakes kept them cleaned out pretty good.
Billy Poindexter was born on March 31st, 1932 in Portales, New Mexico. Billy's parents moved to New Mexico on a wagon. They would later have 13 children. He recalls a close encounter with New Mexico wildlife on his way to school.
We had to walk a mile to catch the school bus, and we walked back one afternoon. I was walking up the borer pit. You know what a borer pit is? It's on each side of the road where they can borrow dirt to make the road. I seen something crawling down in there, and I reached down and picked it up. It had a big head and body about that long, and I couldn't figure out what it was. So I looked at that, and it opened his mouth and had two fangs. It was a baby rattlesnake.
And you picked it up?
And I picked it up.
Oh, no.
And I was very lucky it didn't bite me.
Up next is Claude Leyendecker. His father was originally from Illinois and settled in New Mexico. He talks about keeping things cool from the New Mexico heat in the 1930s and 40s.
Keep things cool, we used ice when it was available, but like you say, our daily needs, if we couldn't get ice, we had spoilies. There's no doubt about it. Everybody had spoilies to a degree. Mother had some type of cooler in the window that on the north side of the house where the cool air would circulate.
Lonnie Harper also talks about cooling methods.
I can remember on the side of the kitchen window, was on the north side of the house, and Mom had built up a little screen,
outside the window to keep flies and mosquitoes off. And then she would hang flour sacks. Flour came in a cotton type. In fact, they liked to buy the flowers because the girls made dresses out of them. Sewing, it was important to the housewife to have all those cotton. Anyway, it was also a good, you could lay those, open them up and lay that out on them, and then sprinkle it with water and have the wind blow through there. Well, it was like our refrigerated cooling, our swamp coolers, it blow through there. And mainly that's where we keep milk and cheese, some of the things that, and there's a little cooler out there. And that was our refrigerator, was that little window out there with cheesecloth or that type of cotton.
Amado Mares was born in Taos, New Mexico, but shortly after moved to the family ranch in Black Lake, New Mexico, where he would live for 9 years.
We had to bring in wood, chop wood first, go out and chop it, bring it in, and then we have to bring the water in, usually in the morning or in the wood, we bring it in the late afternoon.
Okay.
Yeah, so we wouldn't have to go in the morning. And then, but water, I remember doing the water. It was especially rough when my mother had to wash clothes. Had to bring in a lot of water when somebody was going to take a bath. Then she'd have to warm them. You know, use a lot of wood. And then we'd have to lock up the sheep so the coyotes wouldn't bother them.
Oh, yeah.
And after school, I had to help feed the cattle. And it's pretty cold in the winter.
Yeah, I bet.
We suffered quite a bit.
Felipe Baca was born in 1928 and spent most of his childhood living in La Cienega in Galisteo.
He used to cook, of course, beans, potatoes, meats, chili, and she used to make a white gravy and a brown gravy. And then we used the blue cornmeal, atole and chakewi. It's a blue cornmeal. It's made very thick, you know. And that you can eat that with salt, or you can eat it with sugar, milk and sugar, you know. And since we grew all that, we always had a lot of blue cornmeal. And then the meat, you know, it was dried meat. And we used to have a metate, and we used to pound that meat to grind it down. And my mom would make meat with gravy, or she would make chili with that.
Returning once again in these next clips is Francis Beeman and Lonnie Harper, who each talk about experiences hunting New Mexico wildlife.
My dad had a rabbit drive one time where a bunch of people put together, and we heard it going down the road to kill rabbits because they were cutting down, eating up too much cotton when it was young. And he had this rabbit drive, and we killed, I don't know, thousands of rabbits. We pushed them into an area where Black River ran into the Pecos, and so they had no place to go. We run them into that corner where there's no place to go, and had, 20 or 30 or 40 men with all kinds of guns, shotguns, rifles. So, yeah, we did a lot of hunting.
I don't think I ever went to bed hungry, but maybe a little bit lean. Maybe I didn't get all I wanted to eat. But what I remember the most from the time I was 6, 7, 8, and 9 years of age, the kids, we had a little .22 rifle, it's a single shot, about this long. All 8 of us kids had learned to shoot on that single shot .22 rifle. I can remember Dad, it had shorts, longs, and long rifles, .22 caliber. The shorts were cheaper. A box of 50 probably cost a quarter, but a box of long rifles probably cost a dollar. So he would count out 10 shorts and give them to me, hand me that little gun. We would go down to a canyon called John Taylor Canyon. It was full of cottontail rabbits, and me and my sister, that she was almost my age, she had her little .22, and he taught us how to creep around the sagebrush and the mesquite bushes, and it's full of those little cottontail rabbits. They're only about this long, you know, and not jackrabbits are pretty good size. But he said, now bring me 10 rabbits and shoot them in the eye. Don't waste any meat. Don't shoot them where there's meat. And we lived, I mean, I can remember it many a day. That's what we ate was cottontail rabbit. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of them. I mean, you know, four or five at a time. I was, when I was a kid, but when we moved to Forest, I was already 15 years old, and I got to go deer hunting with a bunch of farmers around there. They would make up a wheat truck. You know, the 18, 20 foot bed on a wheat truck that they haul wheat in, the sideboards, oh, 2.5, 3 foot tall, 300 bushel of wheat. They put a tarp up over the top, like putting a tent on the back of that truck. Mm-hmm. And we'd go to western New Mexico to the mountain country, deer hunting. And I remember the season always lasted 10 days. And the school teachers and the coaches and what have you of the little towns around, they knew about this famous bunch from Forest, because we'd go to the Mogollons, which would be the Gila, and camp out for, we usually went for 2 weeks. We'd go three or four days early. And I got to go on several of those, and even though my dad didn't go with me, they found out I could shoot. I was good. I could shoot. And when I was 14 years old, I went with them there. We killed 10 deer, and I shot 9 of them. They said, put that kid out there on the front, because he never misses. I didn't. How could you miss a deer? That's a big old animal. I'm used to shooting wheat birds.
Clinton West was born on January 15th, 1941. He often goes by the nickname Doc West. His family moved to New Mexico from Westville, Oklahoma.
It was hard when we were on the ranch. Didn't have a lot of money. And mother would say something about, well, we don't have much to eat. Well, I'd go out there down at the dirt tank, and those rabbits come in at night to get a drink of water. I'd get a couple of 3 or 4 cottontail, skin them out, clean them up, and have cottontail for dinner.
In these last few clips, we get a glimpse of community and social life through a variety of stories, such as dances, kids playing neighborhood games, and even some village rivalries. Once again, here are Amado Mares, Luis Cabaldon, and Bronson Springstead.
Oh, we used to have a mailman, which we still do. He brought the mail on horseback from Ocotec, 18 miles away, every other day. And he'd sleep in a cabin here by the school, a real rough log cabin.
That'd be a tough job.
But he probably suffered in the winter.
Yeah.
In the summer is beautiful. Like on Fridays, I remember they had a lot of hillbilly music, and I walked from my house. I must have been 5, 6, 7 years old, to my uncle's, because he had a radio. We'd gather around and listen to the radio.
There was a rodeo normally on a Saturday afternoon, and after the rodeo, then the dance, and then after the dance, there was a gang fight. Because there was all these villages, Cabosa, Chilali, Tijeras, and Moriarty. All these villages would all fight each other. And up in Chilali, you'd see the rocks flying like it was hail.
Every once in a while, they would let me buy a comic book, you know, if we went to Gallup. And we learned about football. And I don't know, I bought this book, and it was all about football. And so we got to looking at this thing, and so we were trying to figure out something we could use for a football, you know. And so these kids came up with all kinds of things. I said, well, we could get, you know, next time we butcher, we could get a sheep's bladder maybe and fix it some way where it would be long, you know, like that and everything. And so my mom said, no. She just bought a football when she went. So we used to play football, and we had a great big wide arroyo about a quarter mile from the house, and we'd play in that sand. And we did not know the rules. All we knew is that you had the same number of guys on the same team, and we saw how they hiked the ball, and then whoever got the ball just ran and
you just smash the hell out of them.
And that's how you won.
That's how you won. So we played football. We used to play another game that was, I mean, it was pretty rugged area out in there. So we'd give one kid 15 minutes to go hide, and then we'd have to help go find him, you know. That became really a crazy, crazy game. And they do that now in Boy Scouts. It's called capture the flag is what it's like. But this one kid hid one day in a big pile of brush and pulled it over the top of him, and there was a rattlesnake in there. So that didn't become very popular right after that because my mother had to take him to Rehoboth. So we decided maybe that wasn't a very good deal. But, and then war. Because the war was going, we'd pick sides and have these big wars, and it was just what was going on in the world.
Mary Ellen Warren was born in 1927 on the Sierra Grande Ranch where she grew up. We end this episode with Mary as well as Monty Shriver, who each talk about a few of their favorite games growing up.
Friday night was game night, and so we'd play dominoes or flinch, and Mother made cards, and she put the state on one and the capital on another one. And so we played states and capitals. You know, that was good learning, but we played states and capitals and dominoes, just plain dominoes.
We played capture the flag, and it was on each hill we'd build a big bonfire, and the flag would be there on a stick, and the arroyo in the center was the dividing line. And the idea was to slip up because you had a guard, and everyone else was crawling around in the dark trying to, we went that way and they came this way. And they were trying to, quote, capture the flag. And the idea was you'd slip up, grab the flag, and you had to get it across the arroyo. The first one to get the other flag was the winner.
That concludes this episode of the New Mexico Rural Heritage Oral History Project. All interviews were conducted or supervised by Kelly Jenks, Mary Alice Scott, Kayla Archuleta Brown, and Mariah Ballard. On behalf of New Mexico State University, I'm Jose Loera. Thank you for tuning in.
And there is much more to come from the New Mexico Rural Heritage Oral History Project. We have five more segments for you that will be airing on KRWG News this week. Next week, we're going to take a look at the topic of education. And if you're interested in more information on this project, including the ability to listen at your convenience to any of the six segments, you will find New Mexico Rural Heritage as a program on our program page. You'll find that under radio at krwg.org. We've all made it through another week. For the latest news anytime on what's happening around the corner and across the globe, join us anytime at the region's homepage, krwg.org. Broadcasting from New Mexico State University, this is KRWG Las Cruces and KRXG Silver City. I'm Fred Martino. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.